nearly every kind of creation of man's brain and hand, existing anywhere, and prized either for its utility or beauty, had long been produced in India. India was a far greater industrial and manufacturing nation than any in Europe or any other in Asia. Her textile goods, the fine products of her looms in cotton, wool, linen, and silk, were famous over the civilized world. So were her exquisite jewelry and her precious stones cut in every lovely form. So were her pottery, porcelains, ceramics of every kind, quality, color, and beautiful shape. So were her fine works in metal, iron, steel, silver, and gold. She had great architecture, equal in beauty to any in the world. She had great engineering works. She had great merchants, great businessmen, great bankers, and financiers. Not only was she the greatest shipbuilding nation, but she had great commerce and trade by land and sea, which extended to all known civilized countries. Such was the India which the British found when they came. At the beginning of the 18th century, as the British economic historian Angus Maddison has demonstrated, India's share of the world economy was 23%, as large as all of Europe put together. It had been 27% in 1700, when the Mughal Emperor Aurangzeb's treasury raked in £100 million in tax revenues alone. By the time the British departed India, it had dropped to just over 3%. The reason was simple. India was governed for the benefit of Britain. Britain's rise for 200 years was financed by its depredations in India. It all began with the East India Company, incorporated by royal charter from Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth I in 1600 to trade in silk and spices and other profitable Indian commodities. The company, in furtherance of its trade, established outposts or factories along the Indian coast, notably in Calcutta, Madras, and Bombay. Increasingly, this involved needing to defend its premises, personnel, and trade by military means, including recruiting soldiers in an increasingly strife-torn land. Its charter granted it the right to wage war in pursuit of its aims. A commercial business quickly became a business of conquest. Trading posts were reinforced by forts, merchants supplanted by armies. The first British factor, William Hawkins, found himself treated with scant respect, his king mocked, and his assets scorned. When the first British ambassador, Sir Thomas Rowe, presented his credentials in 1615 at the court of the Mughal Emperor Jahangir, the Englishman was a supplicant at the feet of the world's mightiest and most opulent monarch. The Mughal Empire stretched from Kabul to the eastern extremities of Bengal, and from Kashmir in the north to Karnataka in the south. But less than a century and a half later, this Mughal Empire was in a state of collapse after the spectacular sacking of Delhi by the Persian Nadir Shah in 1739, and the loot of all its treasures. The Mughal capital was pillaged and burned over 8 long weeks. Gold, silver, jewels, and finery worth over 500 million rupees were seized, along with the entire contents of the imperial treasury and the emperor's fabled peacock throne. Elephants and horses were commandeered, and 50,000 corpses littered the streets. It is said that when Nadir Shah and his forces returned home, they had stolen so much from India that all taxes were eliminated in Persia for the next 3 years. Amid the ensuing anarchy, provincial satraps asserted control over their own regions, and rivals for power, notably the Marathas, asserted themselves at the expense of the central authority, many calling themselves Maharajas and Nawabs while owing nominal allegiance to the Mughal Emperor in Delhi. In 1757, under the command of Robert, later Lord Clive,